And, of course, you and Michael Tesserian. And we'll all get together in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Michael Tesserian, of course, and your phone calls. Michael, let's go right to them. They're lining up for you. You ready?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's pick it up. First, O's been on so long. We will go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Greetings.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question.
Yes, you may.
Sure. Well, actually, more than one question, but let me do it quickly.
Because I like you, you can ask more than one.
Sure, I appreciate that. I want to ask, first question, were the pre-dynastic Egyptians green beings, as in the color green?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, and I heard you mention something about a Hermes. I want to ask you, is this Hermes the nine-eater being from the galaxy Ilyun called Melchizedek in the Bible and Tehuti in Tamaré, now called Egypt?
Yeah, same as that. Well, related to Tehuti would be the Egyptian version. That's right.
It is.
Okay, and also, you were discussing about Noah. Is Noah also referred to as Utnapishtim and Zusudra in the ancient Sumerian culture?
Yeah, it's the same, exactly the same. And I believe that Sumerian culture and Irish was also deeply connected, just like we said, the Egyptian and Irish was connected. And I can see that you know your history here. So, yep, the Sumerian culture, the word Sumeria is actually a Gaelic word. It's an Irish word meaning serpent.
Okay,
so the land of the serpents, you know, and the land of Ireland, the connections between Sumeria and Ireland is another whole area that needs to be, you know, studied at some point.
Okay, and the Sumerians and the Egyptians, because I did some research on the Egyptians, and I found out that they were actually Neolithic beings, actually the pre-dynastic Egyptians, meaning these beings evolved from the water, and they actually never had any hair on their heads, and they mixed in with the Sumerians. That's when they actually started to grow hair.
Well, what you're talking about absolutely fits with my research, that a lot of hybridization took place in ancient times. The genetic science was known in ancient times, and the mutations are known. The whole of ancient Irish history is filled with stories about hybrid beings, you see, just like Greek mythology is, with your Minotaur and your Centaur and the unicorn, and we still see these symbols on royal heraldry. We have the stories like you just mentioned about that. We have, you know, Sumerian stories, Babylonian stories about Oannes, the fish god, the fish man. We have Dagon, the fish god, you know, who turns up as the Irish Dagda. So we've got a universal story here about hybridization and weird experimentation, bizarre animals and life forms. Absolutely, you're into the right kind of information, man.
Michael, where do leprechauns fit in with all of this?
Well, do you remember when I was telling you about the campaign of genocide and the whole tyranny of colonialization or colonization?
Yep.
When you annihilate the physical people, when you kill them off, you don't stop there. Colonialization continues when you start to bastardize the culture. When you start to tone down and change, you see, the ancient mythological understanding. So when we have leprechauns and banshees and many of the famous Irish idioms right now, what you see is a sort of a deconstruction of something quite sacred that happened before, you know. So the idea of the little people or the fairy people, this is something that was in ancient society, ancient culture. Later on, people didn't understand it, so they, you know, miswrote it or misinterpreted it. But you see, in the most ancient legends of Ireland, and the last caller should probably be interested in this, and this is in physical historical records that were known. And it actually reminds me of the new Philip Pullman movies that are coming out now, you know, the Golden Compass. In ancient Irish mythology, they claim that astral beings or ethereal elven-like beings accompanied the kings and the nobles, would walk beside them. These are basically disembodied spiritual forces were present on earth walking around with the ancient Irish nobles.
Okay, wild card line, you're up with Michael Tesserian. Hi there.
Hello, George and Michael. Thank you very much.
Sure thing. Our pleasure.
Michael, I just recently went to a psychic, and she told me that I had been a druid priest in a past life. And this was in northern Scotland in the 1500s, from 1500 to 1550. So I just wanted to bring that up because I haven't done any research on the Druidic culture.
And well, remember we were, what's your name?
Ryan.
Ryan. Okay. Brian.
Ryan. R-Y-A-N. Yeah.
All right, Ryan.
Well, that's a good name for a start. It's a very ancient name. And, you know, if you were listening earlier, what we said is that, you see, to the Druids, race didn't matter. What mattered was whether you were a child of the light or not, whether you were a studier of the zodiac, of the heavens, whether you were dedicated to, you know, the healing of the earth, whether you were a teacher, you see. So today it's the same thing, and it's in past lives it's the same story. That it, in this mystery, you know, you can be of any color and of any nation if you are a person who is dedicated to the truth or are a servant of truth. And you see, many people who are being born today, certainly a lot of people who, you know, contact me and are interested in all of these subjects, are people who have this particular calling because they know that either in this life or in a past one or their ancestors were either fighting evil on the battlefields or were doing it, you see, intellectually, because ultimately, as in my work, I emphasize, it is a war on consciousness. So people who have histories like yourself will feel that calling, and a Druid is nothing more than a person who is dedicated to the truth.
Mm-hmm. When did the Druids, like, when did they disappear? When did the culture really start to vanish?
It took place gradually. It wasn't quickly, but two main events saw their demise. One was the invasion of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, as I said, it's not just localized to Britain. Everyone knows about them coming, you see, to slaughter the Druids in Britain and France. But as I said, the Druids were a worldwide organization. So many of the cities and many of the churches and many of the sacred sites that the Greeks and the Romans and later Christians put up are actually physically on ancient Druidic sites. So the first was the physical conquest by sword. As I said, colonialization takes two waves, you see. One is the sword, and then the other is the ideology. And the second destruction of the Druids and their ways is basically through the Egyptian Atenists, who I believe resettled in Egypt. So if you get book two and read it, you'll learn about Akhenaten and his Atenists coming out of Egypt and resettling in Britain. And these are the ancestors, Brian, of the Menzies clan, you see, and of the Sinclairs, and those who are now popularized as the Knights Templar. People who've seen the Da Vinci Code, etc., will, you know about that, and the culture of Rosslyn Cathedral, you know, and all of this. Well, all of these Masonic, Templar, Chaldean, Cistercian monks, you know, all of that group is itself born from Egyptian Atenism that resituated. When they got kicked out of Egypt, they basically situated in several other countries. One of them was Scotland, and they run still. They're still running from London right now. These guys have never disappeared. So they are responsible for the slow destruction of the Druids, and they're also more responsible for the appropriation of their sacred knowledge, which is very key to my work. Because, again, this would be pointless, wouldn't it, if it wasn't for the fact of the stealing of the knowledge and the reusing of the ancient weaponry. You know, you not only massacre your enemy, but you take the weaponry, the vital weaponry that they had, and you misuse it. So instead of uplifting human beings, instead of enlightening them and turning them on and making their lives bearable and knowledgeable and virtuous, you're degrading the human race through the same knowledge, through exactly the same knowledge.
All right, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi, Michaeleen.
Hi, hey, Mike.
Kitty Wilthu, you sound terrific for an Ulsterman.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, I had three questions for you, and then I'll get off so other people can get on. I'm an old hurler from another place, but anyway, Amadon, A-M-A-D-O-N or M-A-D-A-N, I always heard about that, and I didn't know what it was. Another expression is a Mullingar madman, I didn't know what that was. And my last question was, your name, Tessarian, what's the origin? It's not Northern Irish, is it?
No, it's not. That's from my mother's side. It's actually from Tibet or northern India. She was from the Himalayas.
Okay.
And that's where the name comes from.
Okay. Now, those questions again, please. One at a time.
I'm a Don Mulligar madman, and I'm going to get off so somebody else can get on.
Hold on now. Michael, did you get them all?
Yeah, I saw it, but I'm not that familiar with those. I'll have to give that some more thought. Maybe he can contact me by email or something, because it's not I'm familiar with the word Malone, but not Madon.
All right, that's fair enough. Next up, Vince, let's go to our international line. You're on Coast to Coast. Where are you calling from?
Hello.
Hi, where are you?
Hi, this is Don calling from Montreal.
Okay.
Hi, I just wanted to say that basically If you want to achieve, let's say freedom, right? So freedom as in becoming an infinite yourself, like these guys, let's say they're infinite through, they became infinite through their searching and doing whatever they did to us over a period of time, right? Now, they want you to become infinite. The only way to achieve that, in my opinion, would be by forgiveness, because you have to forgive them for everything that they've done to us up till now. Because if you're going to live forever and they're going to live forever, then you'll be battling each other forever. So it's, in my opinion, forgiveness is the only way to achieve it.
Yeah, understood. I take a completely different point of view. Maybe it's because I'm from Ireland, but I don't believe in forgiveness personally.
But then how, if you're going to live forever and they're going to show you that because they have that, achieved that already, then now they give that to you, then you're going to be fighting them forever. You have to forgive and forget, because remember that you're infinite. So no matter what is done, the present moment is always the most important, because all moment to moment is something new in terms of infinite understanding of infinities. So,
well, thank you for
your question. It's always about forgiveness and achieving balance within the moment.
Thank you for your question. I'll definitely take it on board. But metaphysically speaking, I have a totally different look at it. And I guess I look at this thing as being a in-your-face conflict that you got to deal with now. Getting into abstractia of what might be and what might be on the other side or what might be tomorrow is actually part of the arsenal of the adversary. You deal with your adversary by dealing with him right here and now in the physical 3D world and put all this abstractia elsewhere. If you have to have compassion and forgiveness, you should have it for the people that they've slaughtered down through the centuries, the people that they've maimed, manipulated, murdered, and butchered, and put to the sword. Reserve your compassion for those people and never forgive evil. Never have any tolerance. Zero tolerance for evil in every form and every shape that it takes is the only way that I operate from.
Were any of these groups ever established, Michael, for the good of mankind in the beginning?
Yeah, absolutely.
Most of them were.
I mean, okay, if you get into the Atlantis book, it really says that the conflict basically started from way, way long ago. But even though you did have this conflict between the sorcerers and the magicians, absolutely, the worldwide druidic system of colleges that we talked about were absolutely there for, the instruction in the arts, specifically in music. Remember I said that the Order of the Druids was divided into three parts?
Yes.
One of the groups, or one of the terms that was used, was Olam. Right, for the high druid. That's where we get the word oligarchy.
Olam.
Yeah, Olam, Oli. So Oli, mean the high one, and then we have oligarch.
Well, when was the power grabs then for these groups?
Yeah.
What happened?
During the Roman times, basically when it was under... Remember that whole thing where for years and years and years, it was always said that you should never travel to the west because you'd fall off the edge of the world?
Yes.
This was part of the open propaganda. I mean, it's almost laughable now, but people have to realize this really was put into people's minds. And one of the reasons was is because there was an all-out campaign to not even have wealthy men, mariners or people who might afford to put on ships and travel. They didn't even want ordinary people to travel to the west in case they happen upon Ireland and England and find out the incredible ancestral Cyclopean, culture that existed there. So much was the fear, because the whole edifice that we have of the institutions that are ruling the world today, as we said before, would never have been able to, grow. They would never have been able to be born or conceived should this worldwide global druidic system, which permeated Egypt and was responsible for even the Library of Alexandria and all of these things, and was deeply connected to the Amenists of Egypt. These people, would never have tolerated this blasphemy to exist. So the Dark Force knew that it had to eradicate these individuals, and they were, sadly, very successful. And this is what my book goes into, is the story of how that happened and how some of the chief conspirators in this action did, in fact, leave Egypt and resettled over there in Britain, and are behind the famous Templar clans of France and Burgundy and Champagne, and also Britain and Scotland. And that's why you see so many of the lion symbols. The book has over 500 illustrations. So we've really done a great job of putting the illustrations in there for people to see through symbolism also how this trail leads, because there has been a seizure of power. It started with the Romans and then later down through the Christian era. But the conflict has been actually going on, thousands of years even before that, even long, long, long before, you know, Christianity was born.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to ask your guest, Michael, if it's in all of his research, if he came across the leprechauns that are so famous for Ireland, the little people.
All right, touch on that again, Michael, for her, if you would.
Yeah. Well, as I said, you know, there's always a grain of truth in all of these mythologies. The story of the little people, which, of course, Professor Tolkien rescripted in another way in his Lord of the Rings with the Hobbit people. Archaeologists have now found people physically on our planet that were that small and was a race of people. So we know this is true. Again, the origins of it are in Irish mythology, like you say, the elves, the leprechauns. And the word elves in Scandinavian, elva, just means that the white one or the glowing one or the shining one. So it refers to basically disembodied beings who inhabited both the physical and the supernatural, you know, or non-physical realm, and who were able to come through the gateway, you know, between our physical reality and some other spiritual reality. And this is right in the myths and legends of Ireland. Of course, later on, as things get lost and the traditions get, you know, corrupted, then we have, you know, the story of the banshees and the little people, and it's sort of distorted, you know. But just like the symbol of the Christmas tree, going back to the old pagan symbols of the world, you know, tree, etc., and all of these things have their roots in something in the pre-Diluvian days.
Okay, let's go to some more calls. We're going to take final calls right after the break. We're in our floating format, open lines next hour. Michael Tesserian's with us, started earlier tonight. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, and thanks for holding so long.
Oh, no problem. I want to ask Michael a question about the Druids, rather than talk for a second. But first, I'd like to just say that according to plan, it just seems like every day the natural things become more artificial.
Yeah.
And artificial things become more natural. And it seems like, the major key to their power is information about them. And in other words, our ignorance is their bliss.
Do you remember when George was saying, you know, he asked me just now if I was in fear of these people, and I said no. See, they are the ones in fear.
Yes, absolutely. And I think they should realize that in the long run, spiritual things are more important than any power. If they really want power, super-duper power, they should go after the spiritual things, wouldn't you say?
But they can't. Yeah, but they can't do it because they're not worthy. There's certain limits to which they can go. They harbor after terrestrial power. They want world domination because these megalomaniacs believe, you know, that all men should be a herd of animals just to be controlled by them. As we said earlier on the show, this is a corporatization of the human spirit. You're right. It is an artificial, you know, a process in which we're talking about post-human world here, you know, very much goes to the heart of what I've done with my work on 2012. You know, are we going towards a post-human world, a global brain type of world in which man is so cut off from his own emotions, he's so disabled in his own life, he's so traumatized by the media networks, he's so artificialized, he's so corporatized, his sense of individuality is so, you know, limited that he buys in to this global brain, futuristic, post-human, android kind of world. You know, we're on the doorstep, the threshold of something very, very, you know, negative. And my hope is that at that moment, you know, people will wake up because there's a great deal of jeopardy here. The human soul, the human freedom, the human mind is under threat of the corporatization, or more correctly, the colonization of these entities who have no spiritual power. They're morally and spiritually dead.
Stay with us, Michael. Final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, when you were doing your research, was there any one specific thing that popped out that you saw as so obvious on what they're trying to do, or did it all gel together like pieces of a puzzle?
Yeah, it's more puzzle-like. I mean, this thing is a matrix. It is a very labyrinthine. Their control or their tyranny does not take one form. And certainly when you try to track it through history, I mean, you're up against official history. You're up against the lies that have been disseminated from the institutions of power. And so you have to sort of, you know, deconstruct that. So the book is, you know, sort of a balance between deconstructing the lies that we've been told in official history
you know, getting rid of that debris and then sort of looking at the beautiful, pristine thing that rises, you know, from that, which is the truth, which is, you know, who we are, where we've come from, and what our ancestors were actually doing, you know. And also, you know, a lot about how our ancestors thought. As I said, you know, we've been told that race mattered, and we've been told that all sorts of things mattered that didn't matter in ancient times, because these people were deeply religious, deeply spiritual. Their priorities were different. Their sense of morality, their sense of virtue, their sense of humanity, you know, it was very, very strong. And their reverence towards the earth, you know, we've been told a lot of lies. We've been told that history is only, you know, the world began 4,000 years B.C. We've been told that the further you go back in time, the more primitive and barbaric and rude, you know, our forefathers were. I mean, the lies are just so, there's been so much inversion. So, you know, for me, it's a great, it's very satisfying to be able to, you know, bring
my... It's enlightening for you.
Yeah, because this writing of this book specifically has been a great learning process for me. The most central thing, personally, on a very personal note, I don't know about other readers, but for me, the greatest satisfaction was bringing to light, again, the work of people that are my mentors, people like the Commons Beaumonts, you see, and Conor McDarries and Anna Wilkes, the people who looked into the Irish origins of civilization in the past. It doesn't originate with me. It's a subject that, you know, started about 1890 with Anna Wilkes, who was the first woman scholar to look into this subject. Then it moved to a great man called Conor McDarries. And then in the 1960s, to Commons Beaumont, the book is dedicated to him. So it's absolutely the greatest thrill. I mean, I really had a great thrill when I finished the chapter on Commons Beaumont, and I really saw then the book was coming to life. Before that, it didn't look like it was going to happen. So the Commons Beaumont chapter for me is really, you know,
that's
a beloved chapter.
That's
the one that said, okay, I've done justice to this man. I've honored his memory, you know, and to me that is I've put flowers on this unmarked grave of a great genius. So to me that is, a personal great feeling, you know, to have been able to do that and bring their teachings, their work, back to the modern people of the world.
Okay, so, well, go. I'm sorry, Michael. I'll let you finish.
No, that's just been the biggest thrill, is that because I've loved this knowledge on a personal level, but to find an audience who's receptive to it has been the greatest thrill in my life, you know, that this hobby of mine, a thing that was just a personal study, should have such an impact on the world, you know, is just tremendous.
No, it's huge. I've seen you at conferences. I've seen people gather around wherever you speak. It's huge. West of the Rockies, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hi, good evening.
Yes.
This is Ted from Los Angeles.
Okay, Ted.
I don't mean to trivialize the battle of good versus evil. I'm well aware of it every day. But I am curious, Michael, in your opinion, what do you think... When Atlantis and the lands that are under the water now, when they were destroyed, what do you think the state of technology was? Were they industrialized with cars and airplanes, or were they eating out of, like, handmade clay pots?
Yeah, afterwards, of course, the loss of the technology was monumental. A certain amount of it would have been reconstructed in a more primitive way. I mean, you see, technology is two forms, isn't it? You have the physical hardware, and then you've got the intelligence that created it. So, yeah, the physical hardware was pretty much lost. But, you know, to a certain extent, the minds that created it were still in business. So that's, I believe there was a lot of weaponry still around. The ancient Irish myths definitely talk about this, Ted. And also there was a certain amount of, you know, architectural ability, which obviously we know must have existed, because there it is, there it stands, the Sphinx, there's the pyramid, there's these megaliths, you know, something built it. So I believe that a lot of that has been sequestered in more modern times. But the loss of the technology is central to my work, and the fact, and even the existence of the technology is very, very important. And again, you know, as every week goes by, we're learning more and more about the strange calendars and the strange astronomical, you know, timepieces that are coming to light that the ancients had. You know, things are being brought up from under the oceans. And it's confirming the myths. I've always believed that the myths and legends are truer than history, and we should absolutely believe in the writings of our ancestors as if they were fact. And I'm being proved right, because as every new discovery is made from all over the world, you know, it's confirming what the myths have already been saying years ago.
Okay, next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Sean. Great show tonight. I just wanted to thank George, or not you, George, but Michael, for playing a synchronistic role in my spiritual development. I remember like a month ago, I was listening to one of his lectures online, and he was talking about Shiva the Destroyer coming, being aligned with the planet Pluto.
Okay.
And after I was listening to that, I found out that it was the planet Pluto was aligning on the galactic center on my birthday for the last time for the next 250 years. The last alignment was on the 28th of October, I think, which was my birthday. So I wanted to thank him for that. And another thing I wanted to mention, which has something to do with a synchronistic role, I was for Christmas, I was going to make a sigil, like a positive sigil for my girlfriend as a Christmas gift. And she had a dream about a deer, and I looked it up, and the first thing that came up was Herne and the stag. And I just thought it was funny how it came up tonight with you. So I just wanted to say thanks and, you know, keep up the awesome work, and I can't wait to get your book.
Very nice.
Well, so thank you for calling, and you made it very auspicious by bringing up Shiva and the Pluto, you know, and the anecdote about your birthday. I'm glad you called. And it's interesting that we said already that the stag was connected to the female mysteries, and there's your girlfriend, you know, the female having the experience, and as a totem symbol. And it was definitely connected to the lunar cycle, you know, the antlers. I mean, the study of the stag is awesome, and it turns up in the heraldry. Heraldry is coats of arms and insignias of many, you know, I think the O'Donnells and the McCarthy's family from Ireland, they have the stag on their symbolism. But you'll also see it on royal standards and heraldry. Herne, you see, as you said, Cernunnos. Just tracking that alone, just that one symbol, takes you back into India, where they have Pashupati, which is a version of Shiva, is exactly the same god. Has the horns on his head. He's sitting in the yoga pose. The animals of the forest are all around him. In Greek times, you have Orpheus, who's sitting amongst the animals, you see, in the yoga pose with the eyes closed, playing the harp, when the harp is druidic, of course. So, you know, you can track these gods, you can track these symbols, and you start to find out this amazing pattern when you get into the etymology and the history of the word roots and find out that the Greek word for the harp, or excuse me, the Gaelic word for harp was senior, from which we get the word senior, meaning an elder man, and also serenade, when you serenade somebody. So, you know, the whole study of the word roots, like we said, Olam, giving the word oligarchs, not the oligarchs that rule the world today, who are the corrupt people we're talking about, but the original oligarchs, the people who were worthy to be the ritual, shamanic, tribal leaders, because they were put there by their people who trusted them. The bards had to memorize at least 20,000 verses of poetry. The bards were the keepers of the heraldry of all the noble families of Ireland and Britain. This is memorized in the mind. They never wrote anything down. They did use a certain amount of writing, but the bard, which is a person of the Druidic order, memorized the entire family genealogies of all the kings and nobles that lived in Ireland. So if some drunken king in Ireland wanted a refresher on his family's history, he would call the poet or the bard, who'd come in and go, okay, chump, let me show you who your history is, how you go back to different countries, your family tree. And when the Roman soldiers came, and later in the Christian era, the bards suffered the worst genocide. So when I talk about the destruction of the Druids, I'm also including the wholesale destruction of these bards, the famous order of the bards, who were much more numerous than the Druids. The Druids were actually quite a small group. The bards were massacred in a very short period of time, meaning literally months. And the reason why they were targeted is because all the knowledge went with them. It's just the same thing where if you destroy a government office with all the files and all those notes, it's gone forever. It's absolutely eradicated. So this cut the Irish nobility off from their roots. They were lost. They didn't have it written down. They were brainless. And the only people who knew who they were, and the old Atlantean, you know, the Dragon Court, all of it going back into history, was absolutely 100% destroyed and taken. And that is the fate of Ireland. The attack to cut people off from their roots is a very old form of tyranny. And the wholesale murder of the bards is in the ancient legends, or it's in the ancient history books, a slaughter unimaginable in the history of the world.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on with Michael Tesserian on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, that's me?
Yes.
Oh, hi. I want to ask about the name Toth, because that's my father's bloodline, but it comes from Hungary, which is a country with a language like no other, and except maybe a little bit to Finnish. And I also know that it's a name as common as Davis over there, but that they were there before Attila the Hun, supposedly. Now, there's another name, Tuthill, and, of course, Tutankhamun is part of the name Toth from Egypt. Tuthill is an Irish name that I think seems to have some similarities to Tut and so on. Anyway, a grandchild, his middle name is Tuthill, and they call him Tut. And I thought that's really kind of funny. And I wondered if you have any knowledge of the name Toth and whether there's any connection with Atlantis, with Hungary, with Egypt, and so on.
Okay. Michael?
What was the name of the caller?
Toth. Well, no, not the name, but that's the name she wants.
Yeah,
well, sure.
What is your name?
My name is Josie.
Okay.
Well, Josie, you know, get the book because you're going to love it. There's so much etymology connecting to the Egyptian and the Irish in this. But two things I noticed that you said, and they are connected. Tut, T-U-T, which is Tutankhamun, you see, or Toth, like you're saying.
Yes.
And you brought up a name, Davis.
Well, the name Toth in Hungary is as common as the name Davis. It isn't connected with Davis. It's just as common as that. Also,
well,
by the way, in German, Toth is tot is dead. It means dead in German. And I thought,
right. The
Book of the Dead. I don't know.
You're on the right. You're on something there. And there is, in fact, a connection between David or Davis and Tut. Because did you know that the English translation of the word T-U-T is a very poor translation. In Egypt, do you know that instead of being T-U-T or T-O-T, it's actually D-V-D or D-W-D?
Did not David. Know that. No.
Yeah, so Tutankhamun, the T-U-T needs to really go. It's an English, poor English translation. In real Egyptian, it's a D-V-D or D-W-D from which we get the word David or Davis.
Let's go to our next wildcard line. You're up with us. Hello there.
Hi, you talking to me?
Yes. Go ahead, me.
All right. This is just very amazing. Like the other caller before, the woman, this is just kind of bringing a lot of pieces of the puzzle together for me. I feel like it's actually almost a faith, a part of my spiritual development. Anyway, I'm very fascinated by just the roots of words myself. I learned French at one point, and it really, if anything, doubled my understanding of English and really gave me a stronger connection to, like, the Latin and the Germanic and the Greek roots. You know, and I even studied some Chinese and Japanese. But what I really wanted to talk about tonight, though, was just kind of more of, like, around the ancient scripture, you know, and do you believe, I guess, in the lost tribes of Israel?
Well, the book is heavily focused on who were the real Israelites. Who was, because you see, scholars like Ralph Ellis and Mustafa Gadala, these are the people you need to read, a guy called Ahmed Osman. There's been tremendous work. What was the caller's name? What's your name?
Well, I don't know. He's on hold here. There he is. Okay, go ahead. Tyler.
Tyler,
okay.
See, what you got to understand is there's been tremendous work in the last 15 years on the subject of the Israelites. Now, my work expands dramatically on these findings because I think even though the findings are magnificent from a scientific point of view, they're too weak. For me, they're a little bit soft, and they don't draw enough conclusions, and they don't bring it up to date with our modern times and the modern type of, you know, tyranny we're under. But the researches of these authors is fundamental to discovering who the Israelites really were, to discover, you know, that they're not the people who were put in front of us. And my book extensively investigates this, so you know it's a huge subject to go into tonight on the show. But you know, the book too, I draw your attention to the second book, which is Akhenaten, The Cult of Aton, and The Dark Side of the Sun. And basically, all your questions will be more than answered in that one because you know, we go into the story of the ancient Old Testament and the tribes of Israel, you know, very, very deeply. And if you go to the Irish Origins of Civilization, there's excerpts there that you can read. There's also an appendices section. And just a point, George, I want to make is that the word civilization is spelt with a Z or a Z, not in, for people in the UK, just to realize that. It's not with the S.
Okay.
And a second, I have a short announcement to make is that when you order the book and you get your email confirmation, if it doesn't come through in your inbox, it's probably because it's being trapped, as usual, in the spam blocker. So everyone who's listening, make sure that you either lower your spam settings or check the box so that if we're sending you emails or you're receiving a confirmation email of a sale of the Irish Origins book and it doesn't come through to you,
don't be bothering us with a phone call before you check your, you know, spam blocker there.
Very good. Let's go. Time for one or two more. We'll go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. I think
yeah.
so. Go ahead.
Yes, Mike, I got a quick question for you.
Okay.
You mentioned the druid god Hearn. The exact same spelling is how you spell my name. The interesting thing about that is my father is Native American Indian. How can I research that and find out more about Hearn?
Well, it's pretty common. You can look it up on Wikipedia.com, which is the online encyclopedia. I mean, you can pick up my book. Just go online is the best way to research it. Because you're American and you just spoke there about the Native American Indian connection and so on, you want to study the work of a man that I deal with in the book called Barry Fell.
F-E-L-L?
Yep, Barry Fell, the great Barry Fell. He wrote a book called America, B.C., in which he goes into the exact, I draw very heavily on his work because he proved the existence of the ancient Irish in America, being responsible for the mound buildings, probably being the ancestors of the Navajo, meaning that the people that have been put before you as the Anasazi Indians were not, in fact, Indians. The Indians have never said they were Indians. The Indians have always said that they were educated from people from the West. You go to South America, the Aztecs and Incas always said they were educated and enlightened from people from the West, meaning, you know, from Britain or from Europe. So it's the same in the North American Indian. Algonquin, which is the language of the North American Indians in the East Coast and Northeast, is almost identical to Gaelic. We've got the proof in the book. And the expert on this, who of course was ridiculed all his life, is the great American researcher Barry Fell. He wrote two books that you must know about. One is called America, B.C., and the other one is Saga, America. And he will be the one that I think will be fascinating for you from an American context.
Okay, we time for one more call, Michael. Let's get somebody in very quickly. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Yeah, we only have about 30 seconds for your question.
Quick questions for Michael. One was, I've heard him speak before, and he's mentioned that people should make their own mattresses and said it should be based on, like, a ratio, like a golden ratio. Like, how would we do that? And, like, what's the ratio?
Yeah, great question.
Go ahead, Michael.
The ratio is the phi ratio. You should, and it's a part of feng shui. You should design your rooms, the bed you sleep on. I mean, try to incorporate the phi ratio, 1.618. But the answer to your question is really to get a handle on this is to pick up a book by Michael Schneider called Beginner's Guide to Constructing a Universe. So a Beginner's Guide to Constructing a Universe is for a beginner. So rather than me go on and on and on about it, sacred geometry and the phi ratio, pick up Michael Schneider's book if it's still in print on Amazon.com or wherever. And you'll be open a whole world of sacred geometry. It'll transform your life.
I love it. Michael, you take care of yourself. I will personally see you in a few months. Have a wonderful holiday. Merry Christmas, my friend. All right?
I'll see you at the Psychic Spectrum Expo in Seattle.
You got it. That's Michael Tesserian. Incredible work. You really need to investigate it, the Irish origins of civilization and how it affects all of us. I'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Open lines with the topic at hand, and that is, do you have this weird feeling lately? What might it be? I see it in road ragers. I see it at the mall. I see it everywhere. Do you?